Philippians, 4th chapter, Paul writes, "Therefore, my beloved, longed for brethren, my joy and my crown, so stand fast in the Lord, beloved." You know, that's not just words. That is an expression of how he feels about his church and also an order. You're my beloved. I long for you. I want to be in your presence. You're my joy and my crown. So because of all that, stand. Stand fast. Stand and hold the ground. Stand and provide resistance when the enemy's coming in. Don't be run over. I think a lot of times the church misinterprets the meekness and mildness of Jesus as being in a position to be run over. Nope. Meekness and mildness in Christianity is more of not lording yourself over someone, but it is in no way weakness. In fact, it's great strength. Paul goes on, he addresses some issues in the congregation, but says, "I implore Euodia and I implore Syntyche to be of the same mind in the Lord." In other words, quit fight, her. "And I urge you also, true companion, to help these women who labored for me in the with me in the gospel, and with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life." Think about that a minute. Paul, the guy who wrote most of the New Testament, mind you, the man who planted and established churches and anointed and placed ministers all over the Mediterranean basin, gives credit to those people in the pews that helped him, because they were laborers too. We're all in this together. It's a team effort. Some people are the leaders, sure, but just as important as the leaders are the followers. Now, we watch those old cavalry movies. If the guy on the white horse that says charge and waves his saber and rides ahead, if he goes by himself and the rest of them come with him, it ain't going to come out real good. So it is a team effort. We've all got to be involved in it. But here's where I wanted to go. Paul says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say, rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." Be anxious for nothing. What does it mean to be anxious? That means to let anxiety rule. Well, what's anxiety? Anxiety is uncertainty. Anxiety is a cluster of conflicting thoughts about all the terrible things that might happen. Anxiety is unsureness. Anxiety is, well, let's cut right to the chase. Anxiety is a lack of faith, or faith in the wrong thing, or faith that is misplaced. We look at the circumstances, we watch the news, we read the magazine, we look and see what is the latest thing that Facebook has blocked off, and we come together and we don't talk about the goodness of God, the victory of God, the eventual victory over sin, death, and the grave that followers of Jesus have. We don't talk about what's to come. We talk about what disaster may happen next. And what we talk about is what we think about. We rehearse it over and over and over again in our minds, and we work ourselves into a position where it's very difficult, A, for us to live a prosperous and joyful and successful life, and B, it's very hard for God to use us to build up His kingdom because we're all gloom, despair, and agony on me, oh. And if you don't think that that's a problem, let me take you back to Exodus. But I'm going to tell you about a man who was anxious, a man who couldn't see that God had made provision for him, who couldn't see that God was in control. Now, the point I want to get to today is this: God is in control. And although it may seem like you're careening down the hill out of control, that's not necessarily the case. God knew that was going to happen. And He's got a plan for it, and He's got a purpose for it, and He's going to make all things to work together according to His plan for you and for those around you. Now Moses, let's back up and do a little history. Moses, of course, was miraculously saved from Pharaoh's edict to kill all the baby boys. And he was picked up and he was taken into the very house of Pharaoh, and he was raised in the royal household. He had position in Egypt. He had some prestige in Egypt because he was a child of the royal house. Now, admittedly, there were many children of the royal house, But they were all considered to be basically princes because of their being part of the household of Pharaoh. But Moses had another influence. His own mother was his wet nurse. So I'm sure that he grew up not only with the power and prestige of the house of Pharaoh, but also of the tales of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the promises of the promised land. And when he looked and saw the people that he was genetically bonded to, being enslaved and being abused, it had to bother him. So here's a man that for 40 years has this conflicted existence. He's part of the regime that is enslaving his own people. Can you imagine? Can you imagine being in that situation? I don't know that any of us could. But he grows up in that situation, and eventually when he's about 40 years of age, he lashes out. He sees one injustice too many, and he reacts in his humanness, and he kills an Egyptian. Knowing that that wouldn't go over too well, he hides the evidence. What he didn't know was there were witnesses. And when that comes out, Moses does the only thing that he can do to preserve his life. He heads out of Egypt. And he finds himself for 40 years on the backside of the desert in the land of Midian. And he hooks up with a family over there, and he marries into that family, and he has children, and he becomes a shepherd. But you know, you talk about rehearsing things in your mind. I suspect that in the very lonely existence of taking care of sheep in the wilderness, that there was a whole lot of thought process going on in Moses' head. And a lot of it was probably self-doubt and self-incrimination and woulda, coulda, shouldas, and what ifs. What if I'd handled it? What if I had? What if? Could I have done something? And Moses, by the time the events in Exodus chapter 3 come to play, has had 40 years of beating himself up with a stick. And he's pretty much convinced that his lot in life is taking care of sheep in the wilderness. Then we come to chapter 3, and Moses tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. I believe there are no accidents in Scripture. Moses may not have planned to go to the mountain of God. He may not have even thought about the fact that it was the mountain of God. There may not have been any indication or any plan on his part, but lo and behold, where does he end up? At the mountain of God, the place where God dwells. So he comes to this significant location, this theologically significant location. And while he is there at the Har HaElohim, the mountain of God, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. I'm not going to go through the whole burning bush experience, but I'm going to highlight it here and there. Moses is minding his own business. He's taking care of sheep. He's pretty sure that he is used up. There's no way God can use him. There's no way he's going to be any good to his people. He's content with the fact that he's going to walk around behind sheep the rest of his life. But over there, there's something going on the mountain. There's a fire on the mountain. It's just a simple bush. But that bush should have burned up by now. But it's still burning. I think I'm going to go look and see what's happening. God gets his attention. So he goes. Down in verse 5, God tells him, "Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Moreover," he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Why do you think he hid his face? Maybe he was ashamed. Maybe he was legitimately humble. Maybe he felt a little guilty. Maybe he had listened to his own rehearsal of how unworthy and how useless he was to the point that he said, "Oh God, if God's hollering at me, he's going to judge me. He sure can't use me." How many of us have that thought when we hear the voice of God? And of course, the Lord wants to commission him. He says, "I've seen the oppression of my people." And he goes on, "So I'm going to send you." We get down to verse 10. "Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." Nothing, you know. Well, let me go on from there. Let's go down to verse 11. "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?' I'm nobody, God. I got nothing to give. I don't have position. I don't have power. I don't have wealth. I'm not eloquent. I can't speak well. I can't force people to do things. Who am I to do that?" Now, I want you to understand this. God was not in the least surprised by Moses' reaction. God has foreknowledge. God knows how we will react to a set of circumstances before we get there. That does not change our free will to react as we will. It's just simply that God knows what we're going to do before we do it. That doesn't compel us to do it. It's still our choice. We still make the choice. We still say A or B, but God knows which one we're going to pick. And therefore, it does not surprise him when we choose well or when we choose poorly. So God was not in the least surprised when Moses said, "Who, me? I got nothing. There's nothing." So God said, "I will certainly be with you." Well, that ought to be enough for us, right? God says, "Go." I say, "I can't do it." God says, "I'll go with you." What more could Moses ask for? God says, "I'll go with you." But Moses said to God, "Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What's his name?' what shall I say to them?" Again, I don't know if this was as much a legitimate question on Moses' behalf or another attempt to get out of the call. I think maybe Moses was saying, you know, he was working in his mind. He was already going through all the scenarios of everything that can go wrong. And the first thing that can go wrong is I show up and say, "Hey, God sent me to lead you people out of bondage." What God? God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, if he talked to you, what's his name? I don't know. And they run him out of town with a stick. See how our mind works sometimes? How many times has God suggested you go through something, you go do something, and the first thing that goes through your mind is what all the scenarios are that can go wrong with you doing that? Well, gee, if I go down there and lay hands on the jailhouse at 4 o'clock in the morning and pray for the inmates, they're going to lock me up and I'm going to be inside instead of outside. Either that or they'll take me up on the hill to the building next to the hospital. Now, that one's a nut. If I go into a sick room and say, "Be healed in the name of Jesus," the family going to throw me out because they think I'm a nut. And God said to Moses, "I am who I am." What's God's name? I am. "Thus you'll say to the children of Israel, 'I am has sent me.'" So Moses is going through this whole process. And God goes on after this, and he goes on here for another 8 verses, and he gives him specific instructions about what's going to happen. You know, "You'll say this to the children of Israel, and you get the elders, and you tell them this, and I'm going to bring you out of affliction. They'll heed your voice. And then you go tell Pharaoh this, but he won't let you go." Well, wait a minute. What's the whole point if he's not going to let us go? "But I am sure the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I'll stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders." Well, that ought to be a pretty good backup plan, right? I go and I say what God told me to say, and this is going to happen. The king's going to refuse to let us go, but then God's going to step in. Well, that's easier to believe if you have a track record of God bailing you out, which a lot of us do, but we don't recognize. Moses did, but in the moment he wasn't recognizing. Oh, by the way, he wasn't supposed to survive infancy. He was supposed to be cast into the river. God stepped in. And not only did God step in to keep him from being thrown into the river without being put in a little boat first, he arranged a meeting for the daughter of Pharaoh. See, "Oh, what a cute baby. I believe I'll take this one home." I guess this is one of the Hebrews. Gee, I don't know who's going to wet nurse him. And big sister says, "Hey, I know a woman." God's miraculous hand of providence was in play in Moses' life from before he was conceived up until this day. But you see, when it came down to decision-making, when he looked back at the track record of his life, Moses could only see his failures, which loomed larger to him than his victories did. And I think a lot of us fall into the same trap. It's a whole lot easier to remember when we stubbed our toe and fell on our face in the mud hole than it is when God picked us up out of the mud hole. And a lot of us that haven't had, you know, I'm speaking to a room of some people that have some life experience here, and we've all had great victories in our lives, and we've all had great tragedies in our lives, and sometimes the great tragedies are easier to remember than the great victories are. The fact that Moses was living and breathing was a miracle from God, and all he could see was, yeah, but I messed up. And not only did I mess up, I messed up, and then I ran away. And now here I am trapped taking care of my father-in-law's sheep. I can't do it. So we move down to chapter 4. And after God gives this whole instruction book of this is what you're going to do, and you do this, you do that, and then I'm going to step in. And Moses says, but suppose they won't believe me or listen to my voice, and they say the Lord's not appeared to you. See, more what ifs. We'd be better off if we took the what if phrase out of our vocabulary, both when it comes out of our mouths and when it rattles around in our brain. What if is a faith killer. Hear what I said? Doubt. It's hard for a double-minded man to receive anything, Scripture teaches, because it saps faith. And whatever we receive from God, we receive by faith. And if we don't believe that we can possess God's promises, then we're not going to reach out and take them when they're offered. I can't hold them. Moses, God gave Moses a great promise there, and he says, but I can't hold it. I can't hold the promise you gave me. It's too big. I can't. More what ifs. So God's, again, none of this surprises God. He knew this whole process was going to happen. Okay, Moses, what do you got in your hand? Staff. So he says, cast it down. It becomes a serpent. You pick it up. It just becomes a staff again. I'll give you a sign. I'll give you another sign. Put your hand in your garment. Take it out. And it comes out leprous. Put it back. Take it out. It comes back clean. I can do signs to help convince people, Moses. Hopefully it'll convince you too. But apparently it did not, because we get down to verse 10 and Moses says to the Lord, oh my Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since you've spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. First he said, I'm not able. I can't do it. I don't have it in me to do what you've called me to do. So the Lord said to him, who made man's mouth? Who made man's mouth? God did. Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have I not I the Lord? Now, therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what to say. Well, that ought to answer it, right? Open your mouth, Moses. I'll speak through you. I'll make sure the words are right. I'll anoint the words. But he said, oh, my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. It doesn't matter if you'll be with me or not. I can't do it. I'm a failure. I fouled up everything I've ever touched. By the way, if you hear those words in your head, they are not from God. They are from the pit of hell. Those are the words of Satan trying to teach you to destroy yourself, whether physically or emotionally or mentally or spiritually. When you hear those kinds of words in your head, it's an attack from the enemy. It is not from God. So don't embrace them. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Why was God angry? If he knew Moses was going to say those words, why was God angry? God was upset because Moses did not come to faith on his own. He needed yet more encouragement. It didn't surprise God that Moses said, oh, send somebody else. You want to know why I say that? We're going to read down a couple of verses. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, is not Aharon the Levite your brother? I know he can speak well, and look, he is also coming out to meet you. If he is also coming out to meet you, when did he start? Before this conversation. He is coming. He is in the, if you understand the line, he is in the process of coming. That means he's already started. So God prepared the answer to Moses' objection before Moses uttered the objection. This is divine providence. God plans ahead. If you go and you're at this place at this time, the answer will meet you there. That's divine providence. He doesn't wait until you don't surprise him by saying, I can't do what you've called me to do. He's already got the answer on the way. The answer is on the way before the problem manifests. That's the way God works. You may not like the way the answer looks. It may not be the one you expected or anticipated, but God has an answer to every bump in every road of your life. And sometimes that answer is you're going to trip over the bump and fall down and crawl a little while first. Sometimes it is you're going to see the bump and avoid it. Anybody that drove in this morning noticed that the men working sign was taking a nap down in the hole that it was protecting. However, being experienced with that road and looking ahead, I did not drive through the dip. I drove around the dip. I'm sure most of you probably did too. If not, there's a dent in your head where your head hit the top of the car. That's a pretty good dip. God sees it coming. The answer is waiting for you. Aaron's on the way. Before you even said, oh Lord, I can't do it, send somebody else, I'm sending Aaron. He'll be with you. I'll tell you what to say, you tell Aaron what to say, he'll say it. And if that doesn't convince him, I've already shown you the signs and wonders that we'll use. We'll get their attention. God already had him on the way. So We read on, and Moses goes back to Jethro, his father-in-law. Please let me go to return to my brethren who were in Egypt to see if any are still alive. God just sent you to go take them out. I suspect they're still alive. But it's almost like Moses is still trying to work his way through this. Jethro says, go in peace. I think secretly Moses might have been saying, no, you can't go. You got to stay here and take care of my sheep. Could have been. Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go return to Egypt, for all the men who sought your life are dead. Now Moses hasn't expressed this doubt yet, but I can't go back because I got a death sentence on me because I killed a guy. That, you know, before you even go there, Moses, nobody's looking for you to kill you these days. But just let me nip that one in the bud right there. You know, before you even ask. Here's an answer to your next question. Before you can even utter it. No, there's nobody there waiting to kill you. But he goes on and he says, you're going to do all these wonders, but I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. You're going to what? So he goes on and gives Moses this warning that the mission is not going to be all rose petals and sweet smells. There's going to be some trouble along the way. But remember, I'm right there with you. So Moses goes. There's a brief little situation there on the trip where his wife steps in to do that which Moses should have done. On the eighth day, the male child is supposed to be circumcised. It's the sign of the covenant. It's a dedication to God. Moses had not done that to his son. And apparently, Zipporah comes into the knowledge that God is getting ready to judge Moses for not obeying the covenant that Abraham made. And she steps forward and does that which must be done and confronts Moses with it. You know what? You can't be God's voice and God's mouthpiece if you're disobedient to the covenant. So Zipporah steps in and does that and puts that family in conformance with the covenant. And we don't get what Moses' reaction to this was. But I'm sure he had another flash of self-doubt. Woulda, shoulda, coulda. I guess I should have done that. And even at this late date, here's an opportunity, as he is in the process of traveling to Egypt, that he could have had another excuse to say, I told you it wasn't me. I told you I couldn't do it. But apparently Moses had grown in these few days. And he had come to realize that, you know what? I think I've got this figured out. It doesn't matter what objection I give God. He's already prepared an answer for it. So why bother? I believe I just need to do what God is calling me to do. Because every time, remember what happened to the prophet Jonah? God approached Jonah and says, I want you to go prophesy to the people of Nineveh. And Jonah really doesn't like the people of Nineveh. And he has come to the conclusion that the best, if he goes and prophesies to them, then they'll repent and God won't destroy them. So I'm going to go the other way. And he gets on a boat going entirely the opposite direction of where he's supposed to be going. God does not let that happen. And at the end of the storm and the casting overboard and the swallowing by the great fish and being spit out on the beach, we find Jonah running to Nineveh. He came to the conclusion that, you know what? If God told me to go there, I'm going to go there, and the best thing is for me to cooperate because the consequences aren't really pleasant. I think maybe Moses had that kind of a thought process here. Here's the thought, though. Moses was anxious about many things. God came. He had prepared him uniquely for a ministry that he was going to walk in, just as he has prepared each one of us individually, uniquely for the ministry that we are to walk in. We all have many common experiences in this room, but each one of us has very unique experiences. And it's kind of like taking a blank piece of metal that had been prepared in the same way, had been forged in the same way. Here's this blank bar of metal. And we've all been prepared similarly up to that point. But then the blacksmith takes that bar and he applies his unique touch to it. Now that same bar of metal, he might make an axe head, or he might make a knife, or he might make a fireplace poker. He might make any number of different tools or chisels or what have you. And each one of them has unique hammer blows on it that form it into its unique shape for its unique duty. You don't do surgery with a hatchet. You don't cut down a tree with a scalpel, yet they're both steel. And each one is shaped uniquely for its function. Each one of you is shaped uniquely for your function, as Moses was shaped uniquely for his.
as Joseph was shaped uniquely for his, as David was shaped uniquely for his, as Paul was shaped uniquely for his function.
We have a lot of commonalities. We were all sinners saved by grace.
But the unique hammer strokes that have forged us into who we are today are as individual as your fingerprint or your DNA. We don't know when that process is going on. That bar of steel, when it gets thrown into the forge so that the blacksmith can hammer it, it doesn't know if it's going to be an axe or a knife. And it's probably really unpleasant to be heated and beat and shaped and formed and ground and heat treated. But they're all necessary steps in the process. Connie has been, she's over there now, she's not over here. She's moved before she's moved. She's been teaching in Sunday school, up not this week, but the last several, on prophecies on the coming of Messiah. Who would Jesus be? And here's the thing about prophecy. Prophecy is a whole lot easier to see looking back than it is looking forward. Just, people that make predictions. You've heard people that swear by Nostradamus as opposed to those who swear at him. But you never see somebody look at one of Nostradamus's quatrains and say, this is going to happen. They look back through the lens of what has happened and they recognize it in the quatrains, or at least they think they do. Those prophecies about Messiah that Connie was teaching about, they were seen by the sages and they were interpreted by the sages, and that gave them, I believe that this is going to happen, it's going to happen over here, and I'm looking through this lens to see it because this is what it's going to be. But then Messiah wasn't born in a palace. He was born in a stable. And he wasn't rich and wealthy and powerful and had position. He was born in lowliness. They were looking in the wrong place because prophecy is easier to see looking back than it is looking forward. I tell you what else. Prophecy is one thing, right? Prophecy is God speaking to the people and saying, this is what I shall do. But it's not just prophecy. There's also divine providence, which is, you know what? You're walking along the trail, you're starving to death, and you walk along the trail and there's a ham sandwich in a baggie sitting there hanging on the tree next to the trail. That's providence. That's a simple explanation, but hey, look. Providence is God sending Aaron to Moses before Moses protested. Providence is God preparing Potiphar to take Joseph into his house when he was sold into slavery, to elevate him up and to not kill him when his wife accused him of messing with her. Providence is the jailer seeing the potential in Joseph and elevating him. Providence is the restored servant of Pharaoh forgetting about Joseph initially until the proper time and then said, oh yeah, I know a guy. God prepares ahead of you that which is necessary. But it's hard to see the providential aspect of it looking ahead, but you can much more readily see it looking behind. Oh, that's why that happened. That's why I didn't go there, but I went here. Prophecy, providence, and God's provision. Now, that can be physical, that can be emotional, that can be spiritual, that can be in any aspect that you need support. But prophecy, providence, and provision of God are all things that are much easier to see when you look back on them than when you look forward toward them. The Jews of Jesus' day misinterpreted the prophecies about Messiah. And the Jews of this day, those who have not come to recognize that Jesus is Messiah, are looking back on those prophecies and still can't see them. They can't see that He was the one. Because they were looking forward, actually, to His second coming as opposed to His first. Where are we? Are we anxious about many things? See, here's the cure to anxiety. I told you that anxiety is misplaced faith or a lack of faith. It's saying there's nothing bigger than me. It's saying I've got to solve my own problems. It's saying I don't know which way to go. But faith says, you know what? God has appointed a path for me. And He has promised never to leave nor forsake me. And He is a God who makes provisions along the path that He wants us to walk. And He doesn't hide the fact that there might be bumps in the road and crevasses to cross and rivers in flood stage that we've got to somehow get across. He doesn't hide that. But by the same token, He says, trust me, believe me, have faith in me. Go back to that Philippians chapter 4. In verse 6, Paul wrote, be anxious for nothing, but by everything in prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. Let's stop right there for a minute. In everything. What does that exclude? Everything excludes nothing. Everything is everything. Everything. That means every detail of your life, every situation that you come into, in everything, by prayer and supplication. God, I'm a little worried about what's going to come in front of me here, but I know that you're God and I know that you've made provision. Guide my feet to take the right steps. Guide my mind to make the right decisions. Guide my heart to enter into the right relationship. Guide me, Father. That's prayer, just talking to Him. But that's also supplication. That's saying, please help me. Please help me. Provide to me that which I need. But with thanksgiving. Uh-oh. We might get the prayer and supplication part, but saying, I thank you, Lord, for the bumps and the bruises that I've got. I thank you for the scars that are on my body, soul, and spirit. I thank you for this difficulty that I'm walking through. I thank you that you are with me and growing me through these circumstances, which I hate. But yet, if you're leading me through them, I understand that it's important that I walk through them because there's something better on the other side. Prayer and supplication with thanksgiving. Let your request be made known to God. Thankless Christianity. I really don't know if there is such a thing. If to be Christian is to be Christ-like, I don't know that we can truly say we're walking our Christianity if we are thankless. I know that's hard. And God then promises the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. Why do your hearts and minds need to be guarded? To keep the anxiety out of it. Between the devil trying to trip us up and our own human doubts and fears and worries and anxiety trying to trip us up, we need our heart and mind guarded. We need our heart guarded because that's where the Spirit of God dwells and that's where He wants to well out into us. And we certainly need our mind guarded because we'll think about anything. Everybody ever get one? You hear some catchy song and you can't get it out of your head. Heard one the other day and it was in my head for like 3 days. I couldn't get it out. Not going to tell you what it was. Finally, brethren, let me give you some practical advice, Paul says. Don't be anxious. Let your prayer and supplications be made known, and the peace of God will guard your hearts and minds. By the way, peace isn't the absence of conflict. It is the firm conviction that God is God and God is in control. That's shalom peace. You may be going through hell on earth, but you can have peace because you trust God. That's a hard one for a lot of people to grasp. Finally, brethren, let me give you some medicine to go with this, okay? Whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. What do we meditate on? We're supposed to be meditating on the good providence of God. But in practicality, too often, we meditate on the news report or what the commentator said was coming or the latest and greatest thing off Facebook. We meditate on the wrong things. Whatever we keep rehearsing in our mind is going to stay at the front of our mind and it's going to be the first filter every thought, word, and deed encounters. So if we're thinking about the things of God and that's the primary filter, we're not going to have time to meditate on the what ifs and the oh this could go wrong and oh that could go wrong. What's going to happen when this happens? Think about the next step and realize that God's stepping with you in that next step. Think about whatever things are good and pure and holy and of good report. Meditate on those and you won't have time to meditate on the poison. Chew on the candy for a while, folks. A lot of us blow right through meditating on what's good. You didn't get to enjoy the sweet candy coating because you crunched it. We don't get to enjoy the shalom of God because we crunch right through it and we find not the Tootsie Roll center, but something that's sour and bitter and destructive. We blow right through the covering. We blow right through the grace of God and we find ourselves right back on, gee, I heard on Fox News that this was going to happen and I'm really worried about it. One last example. Shane, come on up. When I worked at A&T for nearly 25 years. The last several, in the middle of that tenure, I was in an inside office with no windows, and I had to string a wire up into my drop ceiling to get enough radio reception to pick up WJMD. And I spent my days, maybe not actively listening to it, but passively listening to gospel music and preaching and teaching. And my attitude was really good through a lot of that time. There were a lot of things that went on, but I was able to think first about spiritual matters. It was getting constantly reinforced. I got a promotion and I moved to a new office, and that office had the benefit. There were two offices in the building that had a TV cable in them, my office and the president's office. And I moved into that office, and what I ended up keeping on TV was CNN. That was really good on the morning of 9/11 of 01, or we wouldn't have known what was going on. But most of the time, what that did was I heard the news. And my attitude went in the dumper. I was in a much better place financially. I was in a much better place as far as my position in the organization. I was in a nice, comfortable office with a big picture window that looked out. I could look out and see the birds singing. But what was going in my ear for 8, 10, 12 hours a day was the news and the commentary on the news. And it sucked me dry. What you meditate on, what you think about, what you hear, even if you're not actively listening, you're subconsciously listening, it makes a difference. Meditate on the things of God and you won't have time to meditate on the junk that's trying to poison you. I don't know what kind of an altar call to give in response to this message, but I'm going to say this. If God's working with you, these altars are open. If you need individual prayer, I'll be down front. Come and see me. But otherwise, do whatever business you need to do with the Lord. He wants the relationship restored more than you do. And He's already made the provision for that to happen.